9. So John chapter 9, starting in verse 1. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. Rabbi, his disciples asked him, why was this man born blind? Was it because of his own sins or his parents' sins? Now, this is sort of a common understanding of life. They thought it back then. We think it today. It's almost the karma approach to life. Whatever current situation you find yourself in, there must be a reason why you're there. There must be a cause and effect to things. If you're in a bad situation, you probably did something wrong to put yourself there, or somebody else did something wrong to put you there. Sasha and I are reading the book of Job in the Old Testament right now, and Job's friends are not really his real friends, and they're just telling him constantly, like, Job, you must have done something wrong. That's why God took away your entire life. And he keeps saying, no, that's not what it is. Job at least has that part right. His other thing's wrong. But his friends keep accusing him, if you do right, none of this will happen. Bad things don't happen to good people is the idea. But it's incorrect. Bad things do happen to so-called good people. Bad things happen to bad people. Good things happen to bad people. Good things happen to, who am I missing? Good people. Their understanding here was, well, the man either must have sinned, and they're saying in the womb because he was born blind. So he must have done something wrong or evil to his own mother, you know, when he's formulating in there. Or his mother or father did something wrong. It was their sin, their evil, their bad choices, their rebellion, that the man was then born blind. And so his punishment, in some sense, is what they thought. And they're totally wrong. Okay, this is a karma view of things. This is like what you reap, you'll sow. Now, the Bible does say that, but the Bible doesn't hold to only that universal law. So there's all these exceptions that we know of. Okay, so Jesus answered to them, whose sin was it? Oh, we haven't read that part yet. Okay, verse 3, it says, it was not because of his sin or his parents' sins, Jesus answered. This happened so that the power of God could be seen in him. Jesus says, neither. It's not his fault. It's not his parents' fault. This man was born blind so that the power of God could be revealed in this moment. Now, some people believe that God actually has a plan for this guy's life. He's going to be miraculously healed when he turns the age of whatever he is. But until then, he's going to be blind. He's going to come along. Their paths are going to intersect. The purpose of this man's blindness is so that God could receive glory. Jesus heals him. God is praised, and that's it. Jesus says that's the purpose of the miracle. And other people will say, no, God wouldn't make a man purposely blind for a certain amount of time only so that he could later heal him. I'll leave it to you to decide what you believe about it, but God makes people exactly how he wants them to be. God doesn't make people and then they accidentally turn out differently than what he made them. So my understanding is it was God's intent that this would be this way. I don't understand why. I don't have to. He's God. He gets to choose how he makes stuff. There's an analogy that's used in the Old Testament all the time. Can the pot say to the potter, why did you make me like this? It's talking about an artist making a clay vessel. You know, you kick the kick wheel and it spins around and you build up the clay pot. Maybe you hand build it. Can the vessel say to the artist, why did you make me like that? And the answer is no. You can't say that. There's no business saying that. In the same way, we can't ask God, we can't say to God, why did you make me like that? God doesn't make people and then they accidentally turn out differently. Or God doesn't make people and then say, whoops, it was different than what I intended. And so God has a plan for every person. God has a specific plan for every person. And in this case, I believe the man was born blind so that in this moment, Jesus could be revealed to be the God that he said he was. Goes on in verse 4, Jesus saying, we must quickly carry out the task assigned to us by the one who sent us. The night is coming, and then no one can work. But while I am here in the world, I am the light of the world. Now, just an aside here before we move forward, because the rest of this chapter is going to be this man getting healed and the ensuing arguments and controversy of it all. But one thing on Jesus' mind constantly was when he had the opportunity, he was going to act on it. When he had the moment, he was going to follow through and do God's work for him in that moment. This is a spiritual principle, and it makes sense for Jesus. He only had 3 years to do all the stuff that he wanted to do. And so he didn't have time to procrastinate, to push things off into the future. It's like, we'll come back to that later if there's time. That's not how Jesus works. It's not how he worked then. It's not how he works now. Jesus says, we must do the work of God while we have time. Night is coming. And Jesus was simply saying, my life here on earth is going to end soon. Probably within the next 6 months from where we are right now. And so he said, we must do the works of God while it is still daytime. Night is coming, and then nobody can work. Either you can't see, you miss the opportunity altogether, or whatever. Now, there's a principle in here for us to glean from this. When it comes to doing God's work, this could be serving God. This could be speaking the truth of God. This could be loving people the way God wants us to love, sacrificing ourselves. There's a temptation always to put it off into the future, into a time where maybe it's more convenient for us. A lot of the time, the thing that God asks us to do is inconvenient. It'd be a whole lot easier if we could just control our entire life, control our day, control our week, control our school career, control our job career, control our family, and everything plays out in the exact order in which we want it to. There's a way in which we can try to say, nope, I'm gonna get through my preferred schedule. And as God tries to interrupt us and show us what he wants us to do, we just say, well, I can't do that now. One day I'll get to it. And young people are notorious for this. You think, okay, when you're in high school, you think like, okay, or I'm sorry, when you're in middle school, you think, okay, when I'm in high school, I'll start to do it. Then I'll have a driver's license. I'll have a little more freedom. I can do a little bit more what I want. When you're in high school, you say, when I get to college, then I'll be away from my parents. They won't be watching over me and controlling me. Then I'll have the freedom to do it. When you're in college, you say, okay, when I graduate and get a job, then I'll have the life that I want, of the freedom of time that I want. Right now I'm busy with homework. Okay, you get to post college and you think, man, I wish I had the freedom of time that I had when I was in college. I didn't have to work 9 to 5. I didn't have to have as many bills to pay or many responsibilities. But oftentimes you think, no, in the future, once my life settles out a little bit more, then I'll get to it. Now, a lot of us just grow up in that mindset. It's hard to break free of it. It's hard to sort of snap ourselves out of this expectation that one day, when the time is right, I'll get to it. What's Jesus saying? Don't wait. Do it now. Pretty easy, right? Okay, the hard part isn't doing it now. Let's read this story and kind of see where it goes. Continuing on, verse 6. Then he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud over the blind man's eyes. He told him, go wash yourself in the pool of Siloam. And Siloam means sent. So the man went and washed and came back seeing. His neighbors and others who knew him as a blind beggar asked each other, isn't this the man who used to sit and beg? Some said he was, and others said, no, he just looks like him. But the beggar kept saying, yes, I am the same one. They asked, who healed you? What happened? He told them, the man they called Jesus made mud and spread it over my eyes and told me, go to the pool of Siloam and wash yourself. So I went and washed, and now I can see. Where is he now? They asked. I don't know, he replied. Then they took the man who had been blind to the Pharisees. Remember, the Pharisees are the religious leaders. Because it was on the Sabbath that Jesus made the mud and healed him. The Pharisees asked the man all about it. So he told them, he put mud over my eyes. And then I washed it away, and I could see. Some of the Pharisees said, this man Jesus is not from God, for he is working on the Sabbath. Others said, but how could an ordinary sinner do such miraculous signs? So there was a deep division of opinion among them. And if you were here last week, you remember the same thing was happening. The crowds of people were divided over Jesus. The religious leaders were divided. That divide is just getting deeper and deeper. Verse 17. Then the Pharisees again questioned the man who had been blind, and they demanded, what's your opinion about this man who healed you? The man replied, I think he must be a prophet. The Jewish leaders still refused to believe the man had been blind and could now see, so they called his parents. So they asked them, is this your son? Was he born blind? If so, how can he now see? His parents replied, we know this is our son and that he was born blind, but we don't know how he can see or who healed him. Ask him. He's old enough to speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders who had announced that anyone saying Jesus was the Messiah would be expelled from the synagogue. That's why they said, he is old enough, ask him. So for the second time, they called in the man who had been blind and told him, God should get the glory for this, because we know that this man, Jesus, is a sinner. I don't know whether he's a sinner, the man replied, but I know this, I was blind and now I can see. But what did he do, they asked. How did he heal you? Look, the man exclaimed, I told you once, didn't you listen? Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too? Then they cursed him and said, you are his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but we don't even know where this man comes from. Why, that's very strange, the man replied. He healed my eyes, yet you don't know where he comes from? We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but he is ready to hear those who worship him and do his will. Ever since the world began, no one has been able to open the eyes of someone born blind. If this man were not from God, he couldn't have done it. You were born a total sinner, they answered. Are you trying to teach us? And they threw him out of the synagogue. Why do you think Jesus spit on the ground and made mud to heal this guy's eyes? There's other stories in the Gospels where he just sort of like snaps his fingers or like just speaks or even just thinks it and the blind people, their eyes are open. Sometimes he even just talks and he just says, be open, and their eyes open. Why do you think he made mud in the dirt? Not just mud. He didn't have like a bottle of water and pour it out. He spit. He's like, yeah. Why? I mean, this is like the worst kind of mud, you know? Why would he do it that way? Well, as weird as this might seem, he was trying to provoke the religious leaders. Jesus is trying to stir things up. He's not shying away from this confrontation with them. Probably 6 months, if not a year prior to this, is when he was in Jerusalem, healed a man by the pool. I remember the paralyzed man. He says, stand up, pick up your mat. And they're like, you're doing it wrong. You're healing on the Sabbath, and you can't do that. This is over a year later. He's stirring the conversation back up. He's stirring the same topic back up. Okay, so he's trying to provoke the religious leaders, and this is part of who Jesus is. You know, Jesus might seem like this mild-mannered guy. You know, he's got sweet hair, kind of flows in the wind. He's got a nice sense of style, Birkenstocks and, you know, flowing robes and all the rest. But Jesus was humble and sensitive and patient and kind toward people that were humble and patient and kind themselves. And he was harsh and critical and confrontational toward people who were prideful, who were proud, who themselves thought they were something. He confronts those who needed to be confronted, and he comforts those who needs to be comforted. That's who Jesus is. Well, the man regains his sight here, so it's a miracle. Okay, and in these stories, it's easy to get lost in the dialogue and forget that. The guy was blind. He'd never seen before. He'd never seen the outside world. And so all of a sudden, he's seeing things in color. You know, he's seeing the faces of people he knows. He knows their voices. He knows their presence, but he doesn't know what they look like. And they're like, really? That's what you look like? You know, it's like when you meet somebody that you've only ever known over the phone or at a distance. And it's kind of exciting because you're like, well, I don't, you know, when you see what they look like and they're, I mean, is it just me? It might just be me. I worked from home for a huge insurance company for like 15 years. And so I knew most people just through the phone, and like you meet them in person and stuff. And you're like, I expected you to be like 6'8", you know, and they're like, you know, 5'8" or 5'9", merely average. This guy had never seen before, and all of a sudden he's seeing the faces of people around him. He's seeing his own parents. Okay, it's kind of funny when his parents show up. You know, the Pharisees are like, well, they question the guy, and they're like, well, like, who healed you, and how did he do it? Are you sure you're that guy? You know, are you sure you were blind? He's like, yes. They don't believe him, so they go get his parents, and his parents say, yeah, this is the guy. You know, this is our son. But you better talk to him directly. You get the feeling they were almost embarrassed. They're like, why did he have to get us into this mess? You know, what's happening here? The man is boldly saying, I was healed and it's awesome. Praise God. I can't tell you all the details, but something good happened to me and I'm not going to deny it. I'd be lying if I denied it. The crowd of people around him are trying to guess what happened. How did he do it? The religious leaders are like, how did he do it? We think he's wrong. His parents come along and they're like, oh crap. Like what do we do? Generally speaking, the crowd of people, his parents, they're afraid of what the religious leaders thought. Because here's what's going to happen. You get to the end of what we read, and the man gets kicked out of church. These religious leaders, they were leading what's called a synagogue. Synagogue was a Jewish place of worship. And they just met every week to study the scriptures, sing some songs. Sound familiar? He gets kicked out of his church, basically. The one he had been in all his life. The one his parents go to. Because he refused to deny Jesus. Okay? Parents were afraid that would happen to them. The crowds of people were afraid that would happen to them. But the man boldly and simply just says, here's what happened. I'm sorry, I can't deny it. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, although he does get a little disrespectful at the end, which is pretty sweet. But he speaks plainly and clearly. And he just says, I think he must be a prophet. What do you tell people about Jesus when you're talking to them? If it ever comes up in conversation, you know, you're Christian, what does that mean? What do you talk about with Jesus? He's a good teacher. He's a preacher man. You know, he was God. He became a man. He's the Son of God. He's God himself. He's my Savior. He's my Lord. How do you describe Jesus? Do you go straight on? And you know what? He's those things, and here's what he did for me. He freed me from my sins. He forgave me. He sacrificed himself and died for me. Are you straight up with him like this man? But you kind of talk around it in circles, maybe a little bit half embarrassed, not sure how to say it, but also not sure that you want the other people to hear you say the real thing. How do you do it? Do you do it the way this man did? Simple, honest, direct. It cost him for doing that. It totally cost him. He got rejected by the people he knew. And so he's not just rejected by the church and by the leaders there. He's rejected by the crowd. They're not backing him up on this. Some of them were like, no, it is him. Others were like, no, he just looks like him. They're not backing him up. They're not coming to his rescue on this. His life as he knew it is now different. He doesn't have the same group of people he can go to. But you know what? He just went for it. He didn't let that stop him from following Jesus. And it can be really easy in the security of our friend groups, the security of our family groups, the security of what we know life to be, to hold back from actually saying yes to Jesus because we're worried too much about what other people think, or we're worried too much about what would have to change in my life if I started to really do this. Okay, the man just goes for it, and it costs him. These religious leaders throw him out of the synagogue. Okay, verse 35 says, when Jesus heard what happened, he found the man and asked, do you believe in the Son of Man? The man answered, who is he, sir? I want to believe in him. You have seen him, Jesus said, and he is speaking to you. Yes, Lord, I believe, the man said, and he worshiped Jesus. Then Jesus told him, I entered this world to render judgments and to give sight to the blind and to show those who think they see that they are blind. Some of the Pharisees who were standing nearby heard him, and they asked, are you saying that we're blind? If you were blind, you wouldn't be guilty, Jesus replied. But you remain guilty because you claim you can see. All right, so the man's kind of going through the ringer. Jesus goes and finds him after the fact. Apparently, Jesus is aware that this guy is kind of going through it. And he seeks him out and offers the guy comfort. For one, he wants the guy to know with clarity, this is who did this for you. Do you want this really? And the guy says, yes, I do. Jesus encourages the guy. He comforts the guy. And the man says yes to him. Apparently, there's other people that are nearby, and they're aware of the conversation, or they overhear what's happening, and it's the religious leaders. And they say, are you saying that we're blind? Because Jesus said, I came to open the eyes of the blind, but to, you know, show that the people that think they see, that they are, in fact, blind. And the religious leaders, they knew he was speaking these things about them. And so Jesus sort of rebukes them. Again, he's sort of stirring the pot. He's not doing this privately. He's not whispering a comforting word to the guy. He's speaking loudly. You got to think Jesus had a booming voice because everybody could always hear what he said, you know? You got to think that when he spoke, like, it made noise. Okay. What does he mean about these religious leaders? He says, you wouldn't be guilty if you were blind, but you claim to see, therefore your guilt remains, is what he says. What does that mean? Well, they saw all his miracles. They heard all his teachings. They had the opportunity to see God at work. Remember, they saw miracles, and they wouldn't credit God with those things. They were too fixated on how he did it, not the fact that God was working through him. And so he says, you claim that you see it clearly, but your way is wrong. Your assessment's wrong. You claim that you see, and therefore you're guilty. Now, when it comes to following Jesus for the broader part of the world, people that haven't heard of Jesus yet or don't know Jesus yet, there's a sense in which they're simultaneously guilty for all the sins. They'll appear before God and be guilty for all the sins that they've committed. Like, everybody's personally responsible for what you choose to do in this life. After death, everybody's going to appear before God one day in judgment. And yet, for them, their lack of knowledge about Jesus, their lack of awareness of Jesus, that is going to be counted into their guilt. They're not going to be called guilty for things they had no idea of either. God's going to be perfectly fair in that. These religious leaders, they have extra guilt. They're right up close to Jesus and they're rejecting him about as hard as you could. And so their guilt is going to remain. Their guilt is going to exceed the general population because they thought they knew more. They claimed to know more, but they didn't. They saw Jesus' miracles, but still they refused to believe. Not only that, they were calling him the devil. They were saying he was a blasphemer, which we'll get into in a minute. Now, they're still with him as we continue into chapter 10. They're still with him. This is Jesus still talking, and he's talking to them. He says, I tell you the truth. Anyone who sneaks over the wall of the sheepfold rather than going through the gate must surely be a thief and a robber. But the one who enters through the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep recognize his voice and come to him. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. After he has gathered his own flock, he walks ahead of them, and they follow him because they know his voice. They won't follow a stranger, but they will run from him because they don't know his voice. Those who heard Jesus use this illustration didn't understand what he meant, so he explained it to them. I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. All who came before me were thieves and robbers, but the true sheep did not listen to them. Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved. They will come and go freely and will find good pastures. The thief's purpose is to steal and kill and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd sacrifices his life for the sheep. A hired hand will run when he sees a wolf coming. He will abandon the sheep because they don't belong to him and he isn't their shepherd. So the wolf attacks them and scatters the flock. The hired hand runs away because he's working only for the money and doesn't really care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and they know me. Just as the Father knows me and I know the Father. So I sacrifice my life for the sheep. I have other sheep too that are not in this sheepfold. I must bring them also. They will listen to my voice. And there will be one flock with one shepherd. The Father loves me because I sacrifice my life so I may take it back again. No one can take my life from me. I sacrifice it voluntarily, for I have the authority to lay it down when I want to and also to take it up again. For this is what my Father has commanded. When he said these things, the people were again divided in their opinions about him. Some said, he's demon-possessed and out of his mind. Why listen to a man like that? Others said, this doesn't sound like a man possessed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Again, still talking to the religious leaders. Okay, and he speaks in this sort of parable. He sort of changes the analogy. Remember, up till now, he said, I am the light of the world. You know, you don't have to walk in darkness. I am the bread of life. If you, come to me and eat me, you know, you won't be hungry ever again. Here he says, I am the good shepherd. All throughout the Gospel of John, there's, I think, it's six statements that people call the I am statements of Jesus. And here's one of them. I am the good shepherd. Jesus describing himself. Okay, and what he does is he calls He calls out the false shepherds. He says, people that are not the real shepherd, they try and climb over the wall to get in the sheep pen and try and steal the sheep, try and kill the sheep, try and destroy the sheep, is what he says. He says, I'm the real shepherd. I'm a good shepherd. I protect my sheep. I lead my sheep. I guide my sheep. He said, even says, I know my sheep and they know my voice. They didn't listen to the false shepherds. They didn't follow them. They follow me because they know my voice and they trust me. Okay, so he calls the false shepherds robbers. Now, here's the thing. The religious leaders he's talking to, they want to be the guides of the people. They think of themselves as the shepherds of Israel. And so his analogy, again, just directly crosses them. He's saying, I'm the good shepherd, not them. Okay, the way they were trying to lead you is wrong. It's not life-giving, it's life-taking. They're trying to train you to follow extra rules and basically bleed yourself dry. I'm trying to give you life, is what he's saying. The good shepherd gives life to the sheep. He lays them down in green pastures, it says, which sounds pretty great right now. I prayed and asked God to make the weather cold so that the green pastures, I'm totally kidding. The green pastures analogy would really sound excellent. That's not true. I always pray for good weather every time. Let me see, where are we at? Okay, so the good shepherd, okay, he leads his sheep. This is what we get from Jesus, a shepherd showing us the way, a shepherd leading us to where we should live and play and work and eat and sleep and all the rest. He leads his sheep. It says he knows his sheep and his sheep know him. It says he protects his sheep. So when the robber tries to come in, Jesus takes his cane. He's like, and he just beats away. He protects us from harm. He switches in the middle and says, I'm the gate for the sheep. Okay, so here's what he's saying. In the Middle East, I heard somebody else describe me, and I'm going to steal their story. But in the Middle East, the way that they set up a sheep pen is they have this large enclosure. Okay, think like a cattle arena. Okay, and there's one entrance to get in there, and they probably use stone or the geography of the land. And the shepherds would be leading their sheep through the fields, and at the end of the day, they want to get them into safety so that, literally wild animals don't come and eat their sheep. So they take them and put them in the sheep pen. Once the sheep are all in there, okay, there's no door on the closure. So what happens is one of the shepherds lays down to sleep in the entryway. Okay, it must have been narrow. 5'8", 5'9", stretch out fully. In order for anything bad to get in there, they had to go through the shepherd protecting sheep. They almost functioned as the door. You guys understand what I'm saying? Okay. And he says, I'm the gate for the sheep. You have to get through Jesus to get to the sheep. You also have to get through Jesus to get into the gate, into the sheep pen. He's saying the kingdom of God is that sheep pen. If you don't go through Jesus, you're not in the kingdom of God. If you try and climb over the wall, you're going to get expelled from the kingdom of God. You're not really a sheep. You're something else. And he says he lays down his life for the sheep. So whatever comes at him, try to come through that gate. He's the gate. He's going to lay down his life willingly. Okay, and we'll get to that in just a second. But the idea is that he's the gate of the sheep. Okay, you have to come through Jesus. That's the only way in. Now, you might be wondering, now there's all these different flocks of sheep in the pen. What happens the next day? Okay, they just kind of say, I had 100, and they section off 100 sheep and start walking away. They say, I had 50. You start maybe making some trades of the sheep. Apparently not. And I don't know if this story is true or not, but it's awesome, so I'm going to tell you. So apparently the next morning, they lead the sheep out of the sheep pen, and the shepherd just calls out to his sheep. And the ones that are his recognize his voice and go toward him and follow him. And another shepherd calls out. The other sheep, the one that are his, they recognize his voice, they trust it, and they follow him and go. And so in the process continues. That's what Jesus is saying here. My sheep know my voice and they follow after me. Okay, obviously it's a good time for a cat analogy. My cat knows my voice. But when a stranger, aka an upstairs person, tries to come downstairs, she does not. Okay, she hides under the little table, or she hides under, the chair, because she's afraid of you, all of you. But I come home and I say, hi, Hannah. And she comes running. She makes a little cooing noise. She rubs on my leg. It's a good thing. She's in dad's presence now. Okay? She's safe. She's happy. Jesus' sheep know his voice, and we'll come back to this in just a second. Now, a couple points to hit quick before we move on. He says in here, a hired hand will run away when danger comes. The true shepherd will stay. They're his sheep. This is his life. This is who he's committed himself to. This is what he's committed himself to. But a hireling or a hired hand, they'll run away because basically they're getting paid to do a job. They have no responsibility, no love for the sheep, no care for the sheep. And so they'll run away when danger comes. And he's saying this spiritually speaking, too. It's probably true in real life situations, but he's saying it spiritually. And he's basically saying the Pharisees, the religious leaders, they're hired hands. They don't really care for the sheep. They're not really going to protect the sheep. If things get hard or difficult, they're going to run away. And he's saying, spiritually speaking, there are spiritual leaders that do it as a job. They don't take on the spiritual care for the people that go to their churches. They don't take on the spiritual responsibility for the people that God has entrusted to them. And so they're in it for a paycheck, and they'll run away if life gets too hard, if ministry gets too hard. The sign of a true shepherd, the true minister of God. By the way, do you know what the word pastor means? Pastor, like Pastor Tim or Pastor Jason. It means shepherd. It's the same word. A true pastor of God's people, they're going to protect the people. They're going to be willing to sacrifice themselves for the people. They're not just doing it just for a paycheck. It's not just a job. This is a calling. It's bigger than that. And they'll hang in there and they'll protect their sheep, because they want to do it the way Jesus is prescribing here. Okay. Now, also, he says at the very end of this section we read, nobody takes my life. I give it up willingly, he says. Nobody's going to take my life before the right time. I actually give up my life voluntarily because that's what God asked me to do. That's what God told me to do. And so Jesus' death is not an accident. When he gets arrested 6 months from now, when he gets murdered, this isn't like, it's like, well, everything was going so well until they arrested him. And then all of a sudden there's this big hiccup in God's plan. No, this was God's plan all along. Jesus willingly laid down his life. And until the right time came, nobody could touch him. We read that last week quite a bit. We'll read a little bit here. They couldn't seem to arrest him when they wanted to. He'd sneak off and disappear into the crowd, or the people that went to arrest him would have a change of heart. He was in full control of the situation up until the moment where God said, it's time. Up until the night he's arrested, he's in the Garden of Gethsemane. He's praying before God. He's in agony. He's saying, God, if there's any way you can take this away from me, please. But not my own will, not my own plan, but your plan be done. That night, Judas comes with the Roman authorities and they arrest him. And that was the moment. That was the time. Jesus knew the time was there. That's why he was in such great agony. He said he was sweating drops of blood. Like he was so intensely troubled in distress that he's sweating drops of blood. He knew the time was right. Up until then, he's doing all the things God has had him do. It. While it's day, we must do the work of God, because night is coming and we won't be able to do the work. But nobody interrupted Jesus' plan. It looks like that in the stories we read. It looks like random people came across his path and interrupted what he was about to do. No, that was part of the way it was all planned out. Okay, so Jesus' death was God's plan all along. He willingly did this. This didn't happen to him. He sort of happened to it. All right, verse 22, it goes on. Now it was winter, and Jesus was in Jerusalem at the time of Hanukkah, the festival of dedication. Now, so it's later, time has passed. He's in Jerusalem again. This time it's Hanukkah, which apparently happens in the winter. Hanukkah is the same Hanukkah that Jewish people celebrate today. This actually was not an Old Testament festival that was prescribed by God. Okay, this is in a couple hundred years prior to Jesus' life on earth. This is, we say intra-biblical. It's in the dark time between the Old Testament and the New Testament, where there's stories of God's people, but it's not scripture. It's the Maccabean martyrs. Okay, that's who this is. But basically, what happened is they led a revolt. They took back their country, and to celebrate, they created this festival of dedication called Hanukkah. Okay, Judas Maccabeus, you may have heard the name before, the Maccabean martyrs. And so at the time of Jesus, they were celebrating this. This is what they celebrate today. You guys know the Adam Sandler song? What is it, just the Hanukkah song? Okay, it's a classic. And I expect only our bass player to know it, and maybe Matthew. Okay. Don't, No, no, no. Just by genre of music that we enjoy, the three of us. Actually, maybe Austin. I don't know. We'll find out. We'll play it later. How about that? All right, so they're in Jerusalem for Hanukkah. He was in the temple, verse 23, walking through the section known as Solomon's Colonnade. People surrounded him and asked, "How long are you going to keep us in suspense? If you are the Messiah, tell us plainly." Jesus replied, "I have already told you, and you don't believe me. The proof is in the work I do in my Father's name. You don't believe me because you are not my sheep. My sheep listen to my voice. I know them, and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. No one can snatch them away from me, for my Father has given them to me, and he is more powerful than anyone else. No one can snatch them from the Father's hand. The Father and I are one." And once again, they picked up stones to kill him. Jesus said, "At my Father's direction, I have done many good works. For which one are you now going to stone me?" They replied, "We're stoning you not for any good work, but for blasphemy. You, a mere man, claim to be God." So they ask him, "Tell us plainly, say the word, say out loud, I am the Messiah." They want Jesus to say it. And he says, "I've already told you in a dozen different ways. The works that I've done have proven it. I'm not going to say it." Jesus wasn't going to give them satisfaction in this. And you might say, "Well, that seems kind of weird. Why wouldn't he just say it?" Okay. Following Jesus takes faith. If you're going to follow somebody that says, "This is exactly who I am," you're going to say, "Okay, yes or no." If it comes to following God, it's going to involve faith, belief, trust. We're actually going to have to put some trust without knowing all the facts. And if we knew everything perfectly, faith could be eliminated from the equation. But that's not what it means to follow Jesus. So he's not going to give them the satisfaction here. It's going to require faith. They're going to have to make a decision. The other thing that involves is love. God requires that we love him if we're going to know him. And love always requires a choice. Without a choice, there's really not love. If it's just a set of do's and don'ts, I guess you're choosing to do or not to do. But if you have all the details and there's not a sense of, you know, mysterious or mystery, or there's not a sense of unknown, if there's not a sense of, you know, trust, it probably doesn't involve love either. And so it requires faith. It requires love. And Jesus goes back to this shepherd analogy. He says, "My sheep listen to my voice because I know them. They follow me." And the implication here is that these people that he's arguing with are not his sheep. They can't understand him. They don't understand him because they don't know his voice. He's doing the things of God, but to them it looks like the things of a stranger. He's doing the things of a shepherd, and them as sheep are rejecting his words. They're just ignoring it, really. Now, for us, here's what we want to get to. Do you know Jesus' voice? Okay, if Jesus were speaking, and this could be, you know, crazy as it sounds audibly, maybe internally through your inner person, in the pages of Scripture, through your thoughts of what you're thinking and how you're interpreting it, through the circumstances of life, things are happening, and you think God might be reaching in there and communicating something of what he wants from you or what he expects. Do you recognize Jesus' voice when these things happen? Or does it seem kind of like a stranger? The idea is this. If you bumped into Jesus on the street, would he be a friend or would he be a stranger? Would you know it's him? Would you understand that it's him? I'm not talking about literally on the street. I'm just saying, as you're going through your life, as you're living it out, the things that are happening, do you recognize God's acts in your life? Do you recognize God's voice in your life? Okay, and secondly, do you follow it? It's one thing to be a sheep that knows its shepherd's voice. It's another thing to be a sheep that follows its shepherd. Those are two different things. Okay, again, another great moment for a cat analogy. Okay, my cat knows my voice, and she loves me, but she doesn't always obey me. Okay, 2 a.m., middle of the night, scratching at the door, you know. It's like, I can't get her to stop. So I tell Sasha, get her to stop. She listens to you, you know. It's one thing to know Jesus' voice. It's another thing to follow it. Those are two different things. It says they wanted to kill Jesus for blasphemy. Again, we talked a little bit about this last week. We didn't name it as blasphemy. Here's what blasphemy is. It's misrepresenting God. It's when a person says, I'm God, when you're not God. God is God. He's different. It's when saying God is like this, when God's not like that. God's different, so you're misrepresenting him. It's saying, here's some details about God. Again, misrepresenting God. He's not actually like that. He's different. Here he claims, I and God are one. I and the Father are one. Okay, and the people picked up stones and they were going to throw the rocks at him because they wanted to kill him. Now, in the Old Testament law, Moses comes along, rescues the people out of Egypt. God speaks to Moses on the mountaintop. Moses' face starts glowing. Moses puts on a veil because the people are freaked out that he's radiating, like, you know, radiation. He comes down the mountain. Actually, he doesn't put on the veil right away, but he puts it on eventually. He gives them the law. He tells them what God has told them. And in the Old Testament, the law was God's instruction to the people. And you know what the punishment for blasphemy was in the Old Testament? Stoning. Yeah. They had the right, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Consequence. Punishment. They had the right punishment. They just had the wrong diagnosis. They had the wrong accusation. Can anybody ever, you know, be accused of blasphemy if you're saying the things that Jesus is saying? Yes. Except that he was God. He is God. And him saying it is not blasphemy. The irony in this is God becomes a man, comes to earth, comes to the people that are supposed to know him. And he says, hey, guys. And they say, we hate you. You stay away from us. He says, no, it's me. It's God. And they're saying, no, we don't want you. They kill God, the one that they think they worship, the one they claim to worship. He becomes a man, comes here, and starts to walk amongst them, and they fully reject him. They kill him. And what they want to kill him for is blasphemy. And so all this hatred in their hearts, all this hatred in their action toward him, they think they're fulfilling God's purpose by killing God. This is crazy. You can't make this stuff up. There's some details about the Bible that's like, I think it's true because it has to be true. Nobody would ever make this up. The Jewish people are who killed Jesus. Now, they'll get the Roman authority to come in to actually execute the plan, but they're the ones that take it to that point. They had the right consequence, but they had the wrong accusation against Jesus. Now, let's read Jesus' answer, verse 34. Jesus replied, it is written in your own scriptures that God said to certain leaders of the people, I say, you are gods. And that's a quote from Psalm 82. And you know that the scriptures cannot be altered. So if those people who received God's message were called, quote unquote, gods, why do you call it blasphemy when I say I am the Son of God? After all, the Father set me apart and sent me into the world. Don't believe unless I carry out my Father's work, but if I do his work, believe in the evidence of the miraculous works I have done, even if you don't believe me. Then you will know and understand that the Father is in me, and I am in the Father. Once again, they tried to arrest him, but he got away and left them. He went beyond the Jordan River, near the place where John was first baptizing, and he stayed there a while. And many followed him. John didn't perform miraculous signs, they remarked to one another, but everything he said about this man has come true, and many who were there believed in Jesus. All right, real quick, wrapping this up. Jesus' answer, he says, okay, it's written in your own law. He's saying to them, you're going to try and kill me because I said I'm the Son of God. He says, written in your own law, therefore I called some of you gods. He's quoting Psalm 82. Notice it was lowercase g. Okay, incidentally, this is where the Mormon church tries to make the claim that all believers in Mormonism will one day inherit their own planet, become the Adam and Eve of that planet, become the God ruling over that planet because of Psalm 82 saying, I say you are gods. Because what I may not have got the exact technicalities right, but that's what they believe. And part of their hope for the future is they'll become a god over a planet. They say Adam and Eve was the god of our planets, but they were just a Mormon that came here. They're wrong. They're totally wrong. This idea of God's lowercase g, it's the word Elohim. Okay, it's the word Elohim, and it's used in a variety of ways in the Old Testament, but when it's used of God, it's used as God the judge, Elohim. Okay? In the context of what's being said in Psalm 82, here's what's going on. God sent representatives to his people to lead his people. There's even a book named after Elohim. It's called the Book of Judges. It's the leaders of the people of Israel that God appointed to leadership that carried out God's plan as the judges. So the people had disputes. They would go before the judges and say, here's my case. And another person would say, here's my case. And God would speak through them to offer his ruling and rule over the people through the gods, lowercase g, or through the judges. All Jesus is saying here is that in the past, God appointed people as his representatives, and you accepted that. That's what he's saying to these religious leaders. You accepted in the Old Testament when God appointed people to be his representatives and to lead you, and you respected them as God's appointed. Jesus is saying, why is it wrong if I say I'm the Son of God? Think about everything I've done. It proves that I come from God. I'm just saying the same thing that they said back in the Old Testament. That's why he brings this up here. Okay, and this just makes them more mad. They either disagree, they don't understand the argument, or what. But he's not saying anything about people being gods. He's saying, I am God's messenger from heaven. I've proven it over and over again. And for you to accept it when it happens in other cases, but not accept it here and now, is hypocrisy on your part. It's foolishness on your part. You're not getting it because you're refusing to get it. They accepted God's ways in the past, and they're not accepting God's ways now. That's where they're at.